Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. We've all seen the pictures, and they're always sort of strange and upsetting. In the midst of an old, grainy, black-and-white film, you see a big bonfire. The flames are shooting upward. It's nighttime. And people with armbands are picking up armloads of, oh my goodness, they're books. They're throwing books into the fire. And you're asking yourself, why? Why would they burn these books? And then you realize that on their armbands are swastikas. You're watching a Nazi book burning from the 1930s. Sends chills down your spine, doesn't it? As Americans, we cherish very few things as much as we do our right to free expression, a right guaranteed us by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. It's a right that includes not just the ability to speak freely, but to receive information like books, freely. And it just offends us at a very deep level to think that someone would try to deprive us of that, someone would try to actually suppress books. Well, that's what we tend to think of when we think of banning books, when we think of what's happening right now, this week, Banned Book Week. But is it really that simple? Are all people who are concerned about books and about which books might be stocked in a public library, and especially maybe in a public school library, is it so simple to say that they are just book banners and that they are bad? And that people who are on the other side of most of these issues, who champion First Amendment rights and who tend to have a different take on these removal questions, is it fair to say that they're the good guys? Or is maybe this a more nuanced question? Banned Book Week comes up every year just about this time, and that is the reason we're going to discuss this very difficult constitutional issue. With me to discuss Banned Book Week, and perhaps especially in the context of school libraries, is my former student, Michelle Caggiano.
Hello.
Hello, Michelle. Thank you for coming back to the show. I think this is your fifth visit, isn't it?
It is.
Well, we so do much appreciate that. You've done a great job in the past, and if you keep doing such a great job, I'll be bothering you, no doubt, for years to come. Well, what is this thing we call Banned Book Week?
Banned Book Week is the American Library Association's Awareness Week for books that have either been banned or challenged, and trying to get the books back into the school systems or public libraries.
Okay. Now, when the ALA says banned, they mean removed, right?
Correct.
I mean, fortunately, we don't have Nazis running around throwing books into the flames, but removing a book from a public library can have the same effect.
Yes.
If a child, especially, or even an adult, is relying upon a public state-sponsored library, and that library doesn't carry a particular publication, well, then that knowledge is being deprived to that person.
Correct.
And so that, I guess, is what the ALA means when it uses the term banned or banned books, is when some government entity, some library administrator, some school board member tries to say, this book is inappropriate.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this is a big subject, and we probably can't get to all of it today, or maybe not even this year. Maybe we'll have to come back and talk about Banned Books Week a year from now. But for this year, for this episode of our show, why don't we concentrate on one of the biggest areas of controversy within Banned Book Week? And let's talk about, if you would please, school libraries, because it seems to me, just from my research, that seems to be one of the flashpoint areas, doesn't it?
It is.
Okay, because you've got the public schools, that's a government entity. What's the problem? What happens with schools? What's the governing law?
Well, the Supreme Court said in the PICO decision that...
PICO, right?
Yes.
PICO, okay.
That a school could remove a book, or a school board could remove a book from the library shelves or from the school curriculum as long as there was a pedagogical reason and not because the school board didn't agree with the viewpoint that the book had.
Okay, let me make sure I understand that. You've got a governmental entity that's bound to observe the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects all of us, and even including children. But this governmental entity, this public school that runs a public school library, can nonetheless restrict information.
Yes.
Under certain circumstances, and if I understood you correctly, it's if the school has a legitimate pedagogical reason for doing so.
Yes.
But what do we mean when we say a legitimate pedagogical reason? What reasonable justification might a school have to say, just take a book off the shelf, kids can no longer read it?
Sometimes it's because the book may not be age appropriate. It may have content in it that isn't suitable for a certain age group.
Mm-hmm. What about the perennial issue of language or what do they call it, profanity or vulgarity? Are those also reasons that the court has recognized that you might remove a book from a public school library?
They do, but from my research, they're kind of careful on that, making sure that there has to be some reason.
Because they can't, if I heard you said, they can't just remove it because they disagree with it.
Right.
Okay, so if you had really explicit discussions of sexual acts, that might be age inappropriate.
Correct.
Okay. Depending on how explicit, it might be considered inappropriate all the way up to high school, but certainly we might say an elementary school kid.
Right.
Right? But the court, even as it says you can do that, you can determine age appropriate and inappropriate books, you shouldn't be simply taking a book off the shelf because you're uncomfortable with any discussion of sexuality or maybe homosexuality. That seems to be a flashpoint.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so is that the line then that the court has drawn?
To a degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, they look at, like, there'll be some books, if it's full of, you know, bad language, mm-hmm. you know, really, what is a child going to learn from that book? Mm-hmm. So they'll look
how to swear effectively, I suppose. Uh-huh.
So they'll really look at that. But if it's something that's in context, there's something that the child is supposed to be learning from that literature or that use of that language, then they'll probably allow it.
Very interesting. So we've got a really tough situation that the court has set up for us. The starting point is that everybody has First Amendment rights, even kids. But on the other hand, the school operating in loco parentis and with its mission of educating and even inculcating students with good values has some ability to restrict the information that these kids receive. I guess it's a matter of drawing the proper line, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, we're going to be talking with a couple of very knowledgeable people in this area. We're going to be talking to a representative from the American Library Association. Her name is Deborah Caldwell Stone. And after we speak with Deborah, we're going to be speaking to one of the ALA's more vocal critics, a fellow by the name of Dan Kleinman. And we've got a couple of other interesting people to talk to later. So let's begin by hearing from the American Library Association and its representative, Deborah Caldwell Stone.
I'm Deborah Caldwell Stone. I work at the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, where I'm deputy director of the office. I'm an attorney by training, and every day I work with librarians on censorship and privacy issues that affect both librarians and library users.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why is that important? I mean, do these issues really come up that frequently?
Well, actually, they do. People's right to access information is adversely affected whenever they feel that somebody's looking over their shoulder or when access is blocked by an act of censorship. And both of those things often occur in libraries. Police want to look at people's reading records just to, you know, see if maybe somebody's reading a book about chemistry and thinking about blowing, and they impute the idea that that means they're thinking about blowing something up. Mm. So we protect the privacy of library records. And a decision to remove a book from a community means that all the persons in that community who wanted to read that book are no longer able to. And that directly impacts the right to access information that's guaranteed to us under the First Amendment.
Okay, and these things, of course, we're talking generally about these sorts of issues, but let's try to focus, if we could, on Banned Book Week, which is, of course, our focus on the show today, and specifically as that relates to schools, because, of course, that's a special subset, school libraries of the libraries of country. Could you tell us what about Banned Book Week and how it came about and why it's important?
Well, Banned Books Week goes all the way back to 1982 when a group of publishers, librarians, authors, and booksellers noted that there were increasing incidents where books were being removed from school libraries, public libraries, all across the country. And also looking back to the history of banned books where the post office and customs would prevent certain literature from entering the country. And so they mounted a display at the New York City Book Fair that year that highlighted the acts of censorship. And from that initial set of activities, Banned Books Week grew into a national observance of our freedom to read. And the fact that, in fact, censorship takes place in this country still, even though we have this commitment to First Amendment freedoms.
Okay, so you're talking about libraries generally and generally the freedom of people to receive information, extremely mm-hmm. important and, as you say, guaranteed under the First Amendment. Now, but you also mentioned school libraries, and of course, that's really one of the flashpoints and one of the more difficult areas, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. If you recall, Board of Education v. PICO is the fundamental Supreme Court case that addressed the issue of the freedom to read in school libraries. And what the Supreme Court said in PICO is, while school boards have some discretion to set curriculum, when they exercise that discretion in an unconstitutional manner, they actually do injure the students' First Amendment rights, and that can be remedied by the courts. And what the court said in their decision fundamentally is that they cannot remove books simply because they disagree with the ideas expressed in those books. Mm-hmm. That the books have to be found to be educationally unsuitable or pervasively vulgar. And that's a really high standard to come across. In the PICO case, they actually found that they removed the books not because of any vulgarity or educational unsuitability, but because they felt the books were anti-American or promoted resistance to authority, and as a result, the ultimate decision was that the books were removed for unconstitutional reasons. And there have been a multitude of court cases since then concerning the removal of books from school libraries, in particular, that have told school boards to return books to the library shelf.
Mm-hmm. Now, the PICO case is interesting, but it's also troubling because, of course, it sets up what seems to me almost putting the schools in an impossible circumstance. On the one hand, everybody, including even young children, have First Amendment rights. We all have First Amendment rights. But on the other hand, the court recognizes that little children especially, but even all the way up to high school children, while they're in school, at least, the school is operating in loco parentis, and it has some responsibility to make sure that the materials they get are, as you say, educationally appropriate and are not somehow inappropriate. Where do we draw the line between an appropriate determination that something's pervasively vulgar or otherwise educationally inappropriate on the one hand versus censorship of ideas on the other?
Well, again, you have to remember that the school library was actually seen to be a different place than the curriculum. And so the absolute discretion that's often upheld in the area of curriculum studies by courts does not necessarily apply to the school library. And what the court looks at is whether if by voting to remove a book, a school board or a school committee intended to deny access to particular ideas. And in that case, we look at whether, you know, for example, in one case in Kansas, they voted to remove a book, Annie and My Mind. Mm-hmm. And they found by taking depositions of the school board members that the intent was to deny access to the idea that there were teen homosexuals and that they could have a healthy relationship together in high school.
Okay, Annie on My Mind described or at least dealt with the subject of lesbian relationships in high school, if I recall, right? Okay.
Two girls that had were lesbians and dated in high school. And in that case, the court found that there was, in fact, a substantial First Amendment injury, that the decision of the school board wasn't based on any idea of educational unsuitability, but in fact on their disagreement with the idea of homosexuality or their disapproval of that idea. And in that case, ultimately the school board was required to return the book to the shelf. It's not merely a test where if there is some profanity in a book, because many, many works of great literature have profanity in them that are offered to high school students. And it's not even mere ideas that make something pervasively vulgar. It is, we really see that in these cases that it's more of a matter of the, we still have to look at the work as a whole. You know, the Miller test really sets out a guidepost here. It's not merely that it contains some sex, it's not merely that it contains some profanity, but as the work as a whole, does the work suggest some kind of that the work is obscene as to minors or improper for minors. And you have to remember that when books are challenged in the school environment, a decision's already been made by a school committee, by faculty, by librarians, that the work has value for some students in that school. Mm-hmm. The book is already on the shelf, and it already has passed a test where it's already been determined that it contributes to the curriculum, it contributes to to the reading voluntary reading program, and is suitable for young people.
Well, maybe I guess what this boils down to, Deborah, is then not so much what the definition of pervasive vulgarity is, because you know there is no objective definition of such a
term.
The question really boils down to who makes the decision. And
yes.
I'm guessing that you, generally speaking, side with the library professionals and the teachers rather than with those who object to those decisions.
Well,
that a fair statement? I mean, I don't want to mischaracterize your position, but that's what I'm hearing.
Well, what we argue is that once a book is chosen to be used in the curriculum or chosen to reside on the library shelf, that its removal for reasons that relate to somebody's disapproval of the ideas in the book violate the Constitution. And there are very, very rare instances where, for example, there was a book, Arming America, that was riddled with misrepresentation, fraud in the research, where a book might be removed, challenged and removed on the grounds that it's academic fraud. And or, you know, every once in a while, for example, and I can tell you there are actually cases like this, libraries, school libraries will order books from wholesalers, and a book will be included by mistake in a shipment that is not in the right age group, a high school novel included in a set of books intended for elementary students. And in those rare cases, of course, the idea that the book should be moved to the high school or shouldn't be in the library because of those errors might be supported. But when it's based solely on because somebody says, well, you know, I disagree with the idea that homosexuality should be presented in a positive light and therefore the book should be removed, that's that kind of viewpoint discrimination that should be remedied in this case. And you know, because not every book is for every reader, but once it's in the library, once it's placed there for voluntary reading, you know, nobody's forced to go to the library and read particular books, there is a constitutional right to access those books that should be protected by the courts.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We've been talking to Deborah Caldwell Stone of the American Library Association about Banned Book Week, which just happens to fall this week. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk a bit more with Deborah Caldwell Stone. Stay tuned.
Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. I can go anywhere. Friends to know and ways to grow, a reading rainbow. I can be anything. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Reading rainbow.
Here we are once again gathered for that most august of occasions, that greatest challenge that we have in all of constitutional law, the constitutional quiz.
And with us is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Tremendous. We also have a very brave contestant who's walked in the lion's den. Please introduce yourself, Mr. Contestant, and tell us where you're from.
Hi, I'm Zach Rivenbark from Bergall, North Carolina.
Zach, are you ready?
I am.
You're ready to face the quiz lady?
I think so.
All right, quiz lady, he's ready for you. Let's go.
All right, Zach, I have a question for you. I'm actually going to read a quotation for you, and then you're going to determine what principle or what concept the quotation refers to. And this is, you know, when you study the Constitution, you also really need to go back to the Declaration of Independence and look at some of the principles that are laid out in the Declaration of Independence. So are you ready for me, Zach?
I am.
All right, here's the quote. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Does that quotation from the Declaration of Independence refer to the concept of A, inalienable rights, B, natural law theory, C, right of revolution, or D, social contract theory?
Could you repeat the quotation or question one more time?
Sure thing. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
And what were the answer choices, please, Kelly?
Sure. A, inalienable rights, B, natural law theory, C, right of revolution, or D, social contract theory.
Those are all good choices, and I can see Zach beginning to sweat. Beads of sweat are dripping down his forehead. Zach, why don't you walk us through
this? It's a good thing that I'm not in the studio with you, Stirk, because I fear sometimes that our contestants might throw things at me.
They would. Or maybe they could just cower in a fetal position in the corner when you walked in. But at any rate, Zach, why don't you walk us through those answer choices and tell us what your thoughts are?
Well, I think it's A, inalienable rights.
Okay, why do you think it's A?
It's a guess, an educated guess, I think.
But what about inalienable rights relates to that quote that we just had?
The just powers, I think, led me to that answer.
So justice, the just powers from the consent of the governed. Okay, well, what about B, natural law? Why didn't you choose that one?
I don't think that applies to the consent of the governed people or any powers derived therefrom.
Okay. What is natural law? I've never been able to figure that anyway.
That's why I didn't choose that one, me either.
Well, sir. That's why I always study unnatural law. Yeah, I much prefer it. Okay, so C, what about that one? What was that one again?
That was right of a revolution.
Right of revolution.
Well, I do think that there were obviously rights to have a revolution, or at least we did have a revolution, and I think there were just powers that allowed that. But I'm sticking with inalienable rights.
Yeah, it didn't talk about anything. The statement that Kelly read didn't talk about anybody getting shot.
No.
So maybe that's a good way to eliminate C. What do you think about D, social contract?
Again, I didn't see any reasoning or any issue that led me to a social issue or social right.
Social right. What about that contract?
The contract, I guess, could go to the just powers from consent. But I'm sticking, I think, with A, the inalienable rights, for that reason.
Is that your final answer?
It is.
Kelly?
Oh, Zach! I guess, I know it's a really good thing I'm not in the studio because I think I'd be thrown out. The right answer is social contract theory, but I do like your rationale, and I think you know, Stuart helped you out a little bit with the idea of consent. But particularly that beginning of the quotation is governments are instituted among men, and social contract theory the idea that you're giving up some of your rights to government. Inalienable rights are rights that government can never take away from you. They are your rights. But social contract theory is you're giving up some of your rights so you can govern among men.
Exactly right. And incidentally, let me apologize to all the ladies back in the 18th century. They were enlightened, but not so enlightened that they included women as well. But hey, history is what it is, and we have to go with it. And we very much appreciate Zach's attempt today. It was a brave one.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our subject today is Banned Books Week, and we are talking to Deborah Caldwell Stone of the American Library Association. Where does one draw the line between what one considers vulgar? And many people, you know, acknowledge that many people consider the very topic of sexuality generally, whether hetero or homosexual, to be a vulgar topic. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, many other people don't. And they think that talking about homosexuality or sexuality generally and in a positive light is a good thing. So what's the difference between vulgarity and an idea? And that's really the problem here, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it can't be what's in the eye of the beholder. And access to ideas can't be subject to majoritarian rule or heckler's veto, which often is what happens in school library cases. You know, the idea that, well, because my religious beliefs, my moral stance objects to homosexuality, then that should not be available to anyone else in the community. But we have to remember that our public schools are pluralistic institutions, and they have to serve everyone in the community. Libraries, and this includes school libraries as well as public libraries, need to serve everyone's information needs. And so certainly in any community, there may be a teen who is seeking information about sexual identity and is entitled to read both sides of that question. And the books that do that shouldn't be removed because of somebody's religious or moral disapproval. And it's easy to couch that in phrases like vulgarity, simply because your worldview says homosexuality as a whole is evil. But in fact, we need to take a step back and look at it objectively. Is the book written for young adults? Does it reference sex, or does it actually describe sex acts? We shouldn't disqualify any book or literature simply because, for example, it uses profanity in dialogue, which is a reflection of real world experience. If we banned anything with profanity in it, for example, we'd remove many, many fine works of classic literature from school libraries.
Yeah, well, of course. Now, let me play devil's advocate. Your critics would then say that the sum total of all of this analysis is that anything goes. That means that there are no standards, that school libraries are just the same as other libraries or just the same as the internet, and that therefore everything should go in there because everything in some sense, even graphic depictions of sexual practices, in some sense convey ideas.
Well, I kind of reject that whole slippery slope argument because, in fact, school libraries are stocked by educational professionals who are choosing books to serve the educational and social needs of the students they serve. They aren't out there hoping to stock Playboy in the school library. They're looking for sex ed books that serve the needs of the particular age group they're serving. And we're not talking about where anything goes. What we're talking about is defending the right of those who need accurate information about sexuality and sexual identity, the right to access all kinds of literature that open up viewpoints to different political viewpoints, different approaches to the world, so that youth can exercise their First Amendment right to read all kinds of information from all kinds of perspectives, and that every family in the community can find the information they need in the school library. And, which is a publicly funded government institution, which has to operate under the First Amendment just like any other government institution.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion with Deborah Caldwell Stone of the American Library Association. But she has her critics, as does the entire ALA. And one of the more vocal of those critics is an attorney by the name of Dan Kleinman. I think it's safe to say that Mr. Kleinman has some very strong views.
You can say that I have strong views, but actually I just have the views that the Supreme Court of the United States has. Mm-hmm. The people who have the strong views are people who say that removing any book from school for any reason is always wrong. Those are the ones with the strong views. In reality, when a book is removed from a public school, it's usually done in accordance with a committee who follow some kind of a policy that's written specifically for these kinds of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Each school, for example, has a school selection policy, a book selection policy. And when you have a book that doesn't fall within that school selection policy, you can remove it. And so I'm not the one who's controversial here. The controversial ones are the ones who are saying you cannot remove it. That would be the American Library Association.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it sometimes boils. I mean, the allegation from the other side, of course, is that this removal is used to remove works of great literature or to suppress viewpoints that are unpopular or subjects that make school boards uncomfortable. So their allegation, of course, is that these removals are done not benignly, but with some sort of ulterior motive, which I understand is something that's taboo under Supreme Court precedent, under the PICO case.
That is. And when removals are done in a fashion that violates PICO, then they're not properly done,
mm-hmm.
and they can be reversed. That's why there are so few removals, actually, because PICO allows special circumstances, limited circumstances, for removal of such books. So there's not a big crisis in America, like you could hear, that every single community is banning books like wild. I mean, you actually hear this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not true. It's very few books that are actually removed, and when they are removed, they're usually removed by following PICO. I can give you examples if you wish.
Please.
There was an incident in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, in the Rancocas Valley Regional High School, where a book contained a picture of two men having enjoying each other, shall we say. I don't know what kind of rating is on your radio show.
Uh-huh.
And two Boy Scouts watching them inquisitively. People felt that this was inappropriate for a public school.
Now, I don't want to get too explicit, but was this an explicit picture?
It was very clear what they were doing. Anybody who looked at, who could look at this picture would go, "Oh my gosh, that's in a public school book."
Okay, so that they did depict gay sex, but it didn't. I mean, we weren't showing close-ups of genitalia or anything of that sort.
Right.
Okay.
We do want to be careful that the issue is not gay sex.
Mm-hmm.
Gay is, or homosexuality is not the issue here. The concern is inappropriate material for children that would be covered under PICO, such as things that are pervasively vulgar or otherwise educationally unsuitable.
Right.
There was another school in New Jersey, for example, that just removed a book from a summer reading list where a woman who was 37 or 4, I can't remember, was having sex with a child who was 13. I think that's rape, personally, but
were books that were in public school libraries.
Yeah, public school library. This actually had a recommended reading list for the summer,
mm-hmm.
and I believe they had to read it and write a report on it.
Well, that does certainly, the way you describe it, it does sound like a rather extreme. Do you remember the title of that book?
Norwegian Wood, possibly.
Norwegian Wood. That's very interesting. I mean, certainly the way you describe it, and depending, of course, on the age of the students, it does make it sound like it might be objectionable. What sort of students were being asked to read this book and report on it?
These were high school students,
mm-hmm.
possibly middle school.
Hmm.
But this is the issue. The issue is certain inappropriate material, it happens very rarely, does have to be removed from schools. It does not meet the school's selection policy, and it does not violate PICO to remove them. But when people try to bring up these reasonable book requests and refuse, they get labeled as censors or banners immediately. And the purpose of labeling everybody as a censor or a banner is obviously to send out the message that you better not get involved in such a thing, because if you do, you're going to be labeled a banner and we're going to come after you. And they do.
Very interesting. I wonder if this could, I mean, the basic premise here, at least the balance that I understood the court to have struck in PICO, was that, you know, generally speaking, we acknowledge on the one hand that everyone has First Amendment rights, even children, and that
right.
means to both receive material as well as to speak the material.
Correct.
But on the other hand, as you point out, there is a role for the schools to play in the first instance, selecting books and ultimately, in certain cases, at least removing books if they have somehow inadvertently been acquired in violation of the school's policy. And implicit in all of this is that the school does have some role to play in selecting age-appropriate materials. But that's the difficulty, of course, is balancing those. And so maybe what it boils down to here is who makes that determination? Should it be the school? Should it be the parent? Should it be someone else?
And that is a great issue. And the answer to that is that the school has a review committee or some other kind of a policy that's already in place and means of handling this, and they make the decision. If the argument is made that nobody is ever in a position to make that decision, then you're basically saying it's a slippery slope. If we remove one thing, we have to remove them all. Nobody can make the decision, so nothing should ever be removed, and you're left with the same position that the kids get access to everything and anything goes. You not only have the Supreme Court, however, stating that inappropriate material can be removed, but you have the highest authority in the land when it comes to the Banned Books Week. And that highest authority is Judith Krug from the ALA, who herself created Banned Books Week, who herself said, if on rare occasion material is so inappropriate and does not meet the book's the school selection policy, then that material may be removed. Get it out of there. I'm quoting her now. Get it out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a situation when it comes to inappropriate materials where you have the creator of Banned Books Week stating that it's okay to get rid of, on rare occasion, inappropriate material. You have the Supreme Court stating that that the respondents conceded that pervasively vulgar books may be removed from schools, and that allows you to remove inappropriate materials from schools. And when you follow what the ALA's leader Judith Krug said, and when you follow what PICO says, you're not a book banner, and you're not a censor.
Well, again, I guess it depends, again, on the specifics of a case. Now, you've given us a couple of examples that, at least the way you describe them, sound like, you know, there might very well have been some materials that might have been inappropriate, certainly for younger children. What about the recurrent concerns, however, about banning great works of literature like Huckleberry Finn or Fahrenheit 451 or Slaughterhouse-Five? What about those? I mean, are those the sorts of things that you would advocate being removed from schools?
Well, first of all, I never advocate anything being removed from school. I'm not in a position to do that. Mm-hmm. I just advise communities. Mm-hmm. In my community, it might be a different story. But when it comes to, I happen to agree with the PICO case. If it has political ideas that you don't like, then you don't remove them. If you don't like, for example, if a book does not contain inappropriate sexual material but contains homosexuality, that such a book should not be removed merely because of your opinion regarding homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty clear statement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only interested in advising communities about what PICO says and what even the ALA says about the fact that you can remove books in the right circumstances and on rare occasions. And Harry Potter being, witchcraft is not, I think, something that the Supreme Court would approve of removing. Neither is the Earth being older than 6,000 years. Neither is, just the subject matter of homosexuality. So I would, if it were in my community, I would not approve the removal of such materials.
Okay, well, let me ask you then, Flip. I think I know where you've already mentioned that some of the things that you do think are inappropriate, or at least you've suggested, are some explicit sexuality. Is there anything else that you personally think would be inappropriate, or I should say age inappropriate, something that would be that should be removed from schools?
Well, I think it would be up to the schools to decide this, but I think materials that would, I guess it would depend on the circumstances for this other material, but say the Anarchist Cookbook, which teaches how to produce weapons and bombs and explosives and things like that, that would probably not be appropriate for any class in my I'm just guessing now off the top of my head, other than maybe a chemistry class.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Could be perfectly appropriate for a senior thesis on chemistry or something like that. Chemistry sets nowadays are made so benign that they don't even come with chemicals anymore. You're supposed to go to your kitchen cabinet and get the chemicals out. But so in that kind of an instance, I guess there would be certain instances where some books would be just totally inappropriate for a public school, but I think communities should be deciding that and not somebody like me.
Okay, so it really does come back to who makes the decision. And if I understand you correctly, the decision should be made by some sort of review committee composed of both parents and teachers?
However they do it, however they decide is the appropriate way to do it, and as long as it is a an obvious or a you know, at least on the face of it, a legitimate way of doing it.
You have a website, right?
I do. You can just Google for Safe Libraries blog, and you'll find me, you know, at the safelibraries.blogspot.com. I have a lot of information there, and I'd be happy to assist people if they want to contact me. My first piece of advice is always read the book, and the second piece of advice is either read Board of Education versus PICO or U.S. versus ALA, depending on which topic they're going to talk about.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, and we're talking about banned book week. What does it really mean to ban a book? Is it ever appropriate to ban a book? We've heard from the ALA. We've heard from one of the ALA's critics. Next, we're going to hear from a teacher. What a concept.
At home, sitting in my favorite nook, my girl's trying to get me eat some dinner she cooked. I'm reading a book, girl, I'm reading a book. Don't you ever interrupt me while I'm reading a book. On the shoulder, I got pulled over. Pig's trying to get me, roll my window lower. I'm reading a book, pig, I'm reading a book. Don't you ever interrupt me while I'm reading a book. Why all these people always interrupting me? What have I got to do to try to make them say?
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're talking about banned book week. Our next guest has been a teacher for 30 years, or almost 30 years, and I've known her for 50 years. I should know her. She's my sister. Her name is Stacy Ingram, and I asked her recently what she thought about banned books.
Kind of depends. My experience with censorship has never gone beyond having to give a student an alternate title. Mm-hmm. And I've done that quite often. I will have parents who don't want their child to read Of Mice and Men, or once in a while I've had students whose parents don't want them to read The Crucible.
Oh, well, hold on just a second. Now, Of Mice and Men is John Steinbeck, right?
Yes, it is.
Who won a Nobel Prize, right?
Yes, he did.
And Of Mice and Men is one of his most well-known books.
Probably his most beloved book. His masterpiece has always been considered The Grapes of Wrath.
Right.
But I can say without a doubt that the book that I have most students respond to most positively is Of Mice and Men. Over the years, I have had especially male readers, you know, a young boy, 15, 16 years old, who has never read a book before on his own, other than, you know, with a lot of urging from parents and teachers. They'll pick up Of Mice and Men, and I've had parents tell me they can't put it down. But because it uses a lot of the language that it uses is not that bad. When it was written in the 30s, it was pretty bad. But right now, they only use four very mild, obscene words, if you want to use the word obscene.
Well, with all due respect to our listeners, and I don't want to offend anybody, but I don't want to pussyfoot around this. If we're going to discuss it, let's go ahead and discuss it. What are these four objectionable words?
Damn, hell, bastard, and I'm trying to think. Oh, and they also use the word nigger. So those are the four words that they use.
Those are the four words that they use, all words that are very commonly known, and parents do not wish their children, their 15-year-old boys or girls, to read these words in a book?
I'm not sure if it's... I don't know what the reason is. I've had parents tell me that it's the language. I've also had parents tell me that it's because it's such a sad book.
Well, it's a tragic book. It's one of the saddest books I can ever remember reading. I remember it was very moving.
It is. And there are several scenes in the book where kids are profoundly emotionally moved. And so we're talking about some very heavy subjects, if you will, when we talk about Of Mice and Men. We also talk about the history of the United States when we talk about Of Mice and Men, because it really is a snapshot of one portion of the United States during the Great Depression. The migrant workers, mm-hmm. the hobos, if you will. So it engenders a lot of tremendous discussion, but at the same time, those people at that time did not lead healthy or happy lives, and that's what the book deals with.
Now, do you get the sense that these parents have actually read the book when they decide they don't want their children to read it, or are they simply being influenced by other people who dislike the book?
Well, it happens both ways. Sometimes I have parents who have read the book and have decided that their child is not ready for that. And I do respect that. I understand that one of the problems with public education is that I have a room full of 35 or 37 kids, and some of them may not be as mature as others. So I can respect that.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I have problems with are the parents who, just like you said, have never read the books. We actually, the best story that I can think of a parent objecting to the reading of a book is not my story. It's another teacher's story from several years ago. But our ninth graders read Lord of the Flies. And a parent contacted the English teacher and said, I don't want my child to read this book. And the teacher, of course, asked why. Because often once you talk to a parent, they'll say, okay, I understand your reason for teaching it. That sounds like a sound educational reason. My child can read the book.
Mm-hmm.
But this parent said, well, I don't want my child to read about cannibalism. And the teacher said, there is no cannibalism in Lord of the Flies. And the woman said, well, yes, there is. My friend told me there's cannibalism in it, and I don't want my child to read it. And so the child did not read that book. I forget, it wasn't my, you know, parent. So I don't know what book they read in fact, you know what, I think they actually read something like Pride and Prejudice. It was a male student reading Pride and Prejudice.
Well, any other thoughts about banned book week or banning books generally?
No, obviously, I am totally against it. I guess, especially given, I don't want to get political, but to get current here, especially given the climate right now, with a lot of people not seeming, at least, to trust teachers and the choices that they're making. That is the one thing that I do wish, is I do wish that every parent, that every school board, that everyone who had a problem with the book would come to us and talk to us about it. Because almost always, intelligent people can sit down and they can understand each other. And I guess that's the big thing that I would want to say to any community that is thinking of banning books, is talk to the people who think that these books are worthwhile. And find out what is worthwhile about them. You don't have to believe everything you read. You don't even have to like everything you read. But it's a big, wide world out there. And to confine yourself, especially out of ignorance. I don't mean stupidity. I mean ignorance, not knowing what's out there. I think that's a shame for everybody.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we've just heard from a teacher who had, in some of her experiences with books being challenged and removed from schools. We also talked to one of our local librarians here in Johnson City. We spoke recently to Bob Swaney, who is the head of the Johnson City Public Library, and asked him about his experiences with people wanting books removed from the library shelves.
A few years ago, we had a person that raised objections to an audiobook, and I can't remember the book, but the author was Lee Child, and there was a section of the book that had profanity, and he asked us to remove it and asked the question, what would the children think if they hear it? So that's, I think, a common reason that sometimes people find it objectionable.
What, was it a child's book?
No, it wasn't a child's book. It's in the adult collection. And if I can go back to our collection development policy, we state in the policy, and it is the policy of the organization, that the library does not serve in loco parentis, and we don't serve in place of the parent. We don't try to make the judgment calls of what's appropriate for a child. That's the parent's job.
Right.
So we can't do that for a parent.
Yeah, I imagine if you removed every book with profanity in it, it would be a very thin collection.
Well, yes, it'd essentially only be a children's library. And so that one was kind of an obvious, based on the nature of the objection, we were not going to be able to remove the book as he wanted. What we did do was let him see our policy and try to explain the position of the library and the concept of in loco parentis.
Did he accept that?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then that was resolved amicably.
That was resolved. Most of the time, they are resolved amicably.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times where we've had a book challenged where they didn't ask us to remove it from the library. But, for example, there was a patron that found a book that was in the juvenile collection, and she thought that we had it in the wrong place. And when we looked at it, we agreed with her. One of the things that I'll do, and I take every challenge like that seriously, I never just dismiss it. So I'll look at reviews and see what some of the professionals' reviews say about the book. I'll look at other libraries and see if they have it, and if they do, where they have it. In that case, we did end up moving the book from the juvenile collection to the teen collection because she was right. It was more appropriate in another section of the library. Now, that's a case where we can get a challenge and we're able to work with them because we're ultimately not removing the book. The threshold for actually taking a book out of the library is much higher because that is a constitutional. I mean, you can take that to the Constitution in the First Amendment. And there's a principle based on the First Amendment that we have in libraries, and that's intellectual freedom. We are all free to exchange ideas and to express ideas, even the unpopular ones, or I might even say especially the unpopular ones. You know, in this country, part of the whole notion of intellectual freedom is that a minority opinion or expression is protected speech, and that applies to books. And so we have to apply that principle when someone's asking us to take something out of the library. It may not, they might object to it, but other people in the community may find it useful. So that has to be looked at.
Now, have you had people come in and demand that something be removed from the library, want you to actually ban the book in that sense?
Yes. So, yes, we have. And we have a form that we can hand someone that's making a request of that nature where they can fill it out and kind of try to explain to us what the nature of the problem is. It can be frustrating sometimes when, through filling out the forms, the person indicates they didn't really read the book in question. You know, there might be one small passage that they came across that caused them object to it, so they might not be taking the whole thing in context. But, yeah, it does happen. And I would say I could broadly characterize some common reasons, again, is a lot of times people are thinking about the children, and I would agree in a lot of cases that children shouldn't read it, but there again, that's the parent has control over that. But the objection, the nature of objections can stem from profanity. That's a common reason. Sexually explicit material will cause people to object and want to have it removed. And, you know, probably something to do with anything to do with the topic of homosexuality. That's a hot button thing that gets that bothers people, and they react differently to it. And we've had some objections along those lines. And because we have a policy and we have a set criteria of how we evaluate and judge these works, I feel like we're usually on pretty solid footing with how we're able to respond to them. And most of the time, once we can start communicating with people about why we have it in the library or why we want to keep it in the library, they're understanding.
Okay. Anything else about banned books for Banned Book Week?
Well, no, I just appreciate that you're doing a show on it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob. Well, Michelle, we have heard from a variety of people today on their feelings about banned books, especially, not exclusively, but especially in the schools. Now, you're a former teacher, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes. So you've actually had some teaching experience as well, and you're a lover of books, aren't you?
I am.
Well, then, do you have any concluding thoughts about Banned Book Week or about banned books in general?
Well, I happen to have a list of the most famous books that have been banned or challenged. Number 10 is Catcher in the Rye.
Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield, I guess he was just smoking too many cigarettes and using a few too many bad words.
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Number 9 was Candide.
Candide. By Voltaire.
Voltaire, yes.
That's one of the great classics of French literature.
Yes.
What was wrong with Candide?
It was actually banned by the Catholic Church.
I see. And once again, we have to say bans take many forms. Sometimes they're religious in nature. Sometimes a government gets in. Sometimes they are, you know, actually destroying books and in the extreme circumstance. And more often, at least in the modern day America, it's simply removing the book from a public library or school library. But with that said, let's continue on the list here.
Number 8 was Color Purple.
The Color Purple?
Yes. It was challenged because of sexual assault and abuse.
Well, wasn't that the point? Was that the... Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, the woman was abused. And she
was.
Okay, and she didn't like it. I think that was kind of the point of that book. Let's go on.
A Call of the Wild.
What, too many wolves?
Well, apparently it was challenged because it was a little too radical.
Radical?
Yes.
Radical wolves. Okay, go on, please, please.
And number six was Brave New World.
Brave New World. Yes. Well, they did have interesting ideas about sex in that book.
Yes, but it was a novel, a satire, basically.
Yeah, it was a dystopian world. The whole point was that it wasn't a very nice place to be.
Right.
Okay.
And Bell Jar was number five.
The Bell Jar. I'm not familiar with The Bell Jar. Maybe I should be.
It was a coming-of-age story of a woman that suffered from mental illness.
And what was the problem there?
She suffered from mental illness.
Well, I guess an unpleasant topic. All right, please continue.
Awakening.
Awakening.
Yes, by Kate Chopin.
And what was the problem with that book? Too much caffeine?
That one, she was coming of age again, identifying herself, so there was a lot of immoral and scandalous issues in there.
Well, it's because we all know that young women coming of age never have immoral or scandalous thoughts, now do they?
No.
No, never, so that's a pure fantasy. All right, go on.
Then we have Arabian Nights.
The Arabian Nights.
Yes.
I guess some steamy stuff happened some of those nights. What else?
We have number two is Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl.
The Diary of Anne Frank. What, too many Nazis?
It was sexually offensive, apparently.
Wait a minute. There were 15 people stuck in one big room. How much sex did I don't remember any sex in that book.
Oh, well, we've also heard, as far as with Challenge, that they considered it a real downer.
The whole Holocaust was a downer. I'm sorry. I shouldn't let my personal views get involved here. All right. What's the number one most banned book in the United States? Huck Finn.
Yes.
What is the problem with Mark Twain's arguably greatest book?
Well, in the Concord Public Library in the 1800s said it was trash, suitable only for the slums.
Trash suitable only for the slums. I've heard of modern-day bans of Mark Twain. I've even heard of a modern-day Baudelaireized version of it that removes unpleasant racial references.
Yes.
But, you know, I was taught when I read that book way back in high school years and years ago that one of the things that made it great, in fact, made it arguably the first great American novel, was that it was the use of the vernacular.
Mm-hmm.
And so... that's tragic that the very thing that makes it so strong, the dialogue, is the subject of so many complaints.
It was too real.
Too real. Well, maybe that's the problem with lots of books. They're just too real, and maybe people don't like that reality. Okay, well, I think that's about as much time as we have today to talk about Banned Book Week. I want to thank our various guests. They include Deborah Caldwell Stone from the American Library Association. They include Dan Kleinman, who's a critic of the ALA and who has a different take on so-called banned books. They include my sister, Stacey Ingram, who is a public school English teacher of 30 years standing. And, of course, they also include our local librarian, Bob Swaney, who shared with us some of his experiences right here in Johnson City with books that are challenged and that people want removed from the shelves. I also want to, of course, thank you, Michelle.
No problem.
I appreciate your coming in, as always. And, of course, my executive producer, Wayne Winkler, here at WETS. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.